loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we're going to do a story about Donald Trump's visit to Pittsburgh in the wake of the fascist-inspired massacre at the synagogue in Squirrel Hill, Pittsburgh. And then we continue our weekly series, it's every Tuesday, called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump said in an HBO documentary that will be broadcast on Sunday that he would seek to end birthright citizenship by executive order. Birthright citizenship is automatic American citizenship for any person born in the United States. Apparently, he hasn't bothered to read the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Next, a judge in Ecuador has ruled against WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange, who had contested new rules imposed on him in the country's embassy in London. The judge said a requirement to pay for internet use and to clean up after his cat did not violate his right to asylum. Assange had argued that the conditions violated his fundamental rights and freedoms and were intended to force him to leave the embassy. His lawyers have appealed the ruling. Then, Marina Butina, a Russian graduate student being held without bail for conspiracy to fail to register as a foreign agent, is now being accused of being involved in cyber warfare, according to the Associated Press. The only problem is that Butina wasn't involved in cyber warfare. When she was studying at American University in Washington, one of her professors asked her to gather information on the cyber defenses of U.S. nonprofits for a study he was doing. That's it. And then the New York Times reported yesterday that South Korean President Moon Jae-in is succeeding where all of his predecessors have failed, in engaging North Korea and convincing that country to give up its nuclear weapons program. But the article is not complimentary. It quotes a South Korean newspaper as saying that Moon is Kim's most effective spokesman, and it quotes an American think tank analyst as saying Moon is, quote, a bad moon on the rise, unquote. That's quoting an old Creedence Clearwater Revival song. And finally, Hillary Clinton told an audience in New York a few days ago that she still would like to be president. When asked if she would run again, she said no, paused, said no again, and then said that, well, sure, she'd like to be president. The interviewer says that the public has overreacted to the statement, but Clinton supporters relish the notion of another campaign against Donald Trump. And in other headlines, 10,000 additional troops from the Saudi-led coalition waging war against Yemen are headed to the crucial port city of Hodeidah. The city is controlled by the Houthi rebel movement and has been besieged for months. This has greatly exacerbated the humanitarian situation in Yemen by impeding the flow of life-saving medical and food aid. In the last 40 years, the world's population of mammals, birds, fish, reptiles, and amphibians have had, on average, a 60% decline. This is according to a report released by the World Wildlife Fund, which also notes that the world has lost half of its shallow water corals in the last 30 years, and that a fifth of the Amazon rainforest has disappeared in the last 50 years. The reaction to the tragic crash that killed all 189 people aboard a plane operated by Lion Air in Indonesia continues. The country's transport minister announced that all Boeing 737 MAX airliners operated by Lion Air would be inspected. The same order was applied to Garuda Airlines, the national carrier. Notorious crime boss Whitey Bulger was murdered today in a prison in West Virginia. He was killed in his cell just one day after his transfer to that facility. Bulger presided over a criminal empire in Boston and has been found by a jury to have been involved in at least 11 killings in the 1970s and 1980s. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Pittsburgh. Funeral services were held today for the victims of the anti-Semitic massacre at Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh as the city and the country mourn the loss of life in this brazen fascist terror attack carried out by a white supremacist. Donald Trump is also on his way to the city as he continues to face criticism over the impact of his rhetoric on the political climate in the country. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of several books, including The Plot to Control the World, how the U.S. spent billions to change the outcome of elections around the world. And we're joined in studio by Eugene Puryear. Eugene is the host of the Sputnik News show By Any Means Necessary, which airs every day 2 to 4 p.m., 105.5 FM, 1390 AM, and of course at SputnikNews.com, not to mention Spotify, iTunes Radio, iHeartRadio, and Spreaker. Dan Kovalik, Eugene Puryear, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Dan, let's start with you in Pittsburgh. A lot of criticism coming from within the Jewish community, in particular amongst progressive Jews in Pittsburgh, who say, not welcome. Your rhetoric, Donald Trump, has contributed to a climate that facilitates these kind of attacks, not necessarily blaming Trump personally, but certainly blaming or attributing the political climate that Donald Trump has contributed. Others, including the rabbi of the synagogue where the massacre happened, say to Donald Trump, no, come. Anyway, what's going on in Pittsburgh?
Well, as you say, that you know, there's two minds about him coming. There is a large group of Pittsburghers, including amongst the Jewish community, who've made it clear and signed petitions that they don't want Trump here. And there are at least two protests planned this afternoon in Squirrel Hill against Trump coming, again, because people are of the view that he has both explicitly and implicitly encouraged white nationalists in their rhetoric, and frankly has not denounced them when they have actually turned rhetoric into violence. And so a lot of people feel that his being here will only feed the flames.
Eugene, you and I were talking earlier today about the speech that Mike Pence made regarding Pittsburgh, quite something. I want you to comment, if you would, about that. But also, you know, there's sort of a line going around, which is that the Republicans blame the Democrats, or the Republicans blame the Democratic-oriented media for the political climate in the country. On the other side, people say, well, Donald Trump is responsible, and his rhetoric regarding, say, Charlottesville, where the fascist demonstrators were chanting, Jews will not replace us, and then Donald Trump said, hey, there's very fine people on both sides, that's what's the problem. When Donald Trump isn't welcomed by some in Pittsburgh under these kind of circumstances, it's unusual for the president, even in a partisan polarized environment, for people to say to the president of the United States, we don't want you. What do you think the main reason is? And talk again about Mike Pence's intervention.
Well, I'm glad you tied those two things together, because I think the reasoning is tied so heavily to the symbolism of what Mike Pence did. And that was to bring a rabbi to, or so-called rabbi, I should say, to bring a prayer at the beginning of this campaign rally. This so-called rabbi is actually a messianic Jew, a Jews for Jesus type person, a religious sect whose entire existence is designed to convert Jews basically to Christianity. Now, of course, Pence, I had no idea who this person was, whatever, whatever. But the level of intolerance that is shown by having someone like this up there, even invited to the event in and of itself by a congresswoman who is, or someone running for Congress who is appearing there, I think speaks to what a lot of people in the Jewish community in Pittsburgh, and I think many communities of color and just people of conscience around the country feel about Donald Trump. It's not that it's Donald Trump explicitly. It's that, even though it is him explicitly, but it's that Donald Trump's whole presidency has served to sort of give the green light and to lift the lid off a lot of this sort of dog whistle politics the Republicans have trafficked in for, you know, 30 or 40 years now. They've moved on from the dog whistle to the foghorn. And I think the reality of it is here is when you look at, I mean, you look at some of these people, Steve Scalise, who once said that he was like David Duke without the baggage, right? I mean, you've got plenty of people just like this with rhetoric that is so terrible. Mitch McConnell appearing with these, you know, Confederate style reenactors in one of his campaigns. But people felt like, well, we got to use these dog whistles. We got to find ways to talk about and to motivate people basically on a white power ethno-nationalistic way that doesn't appear that way. But what Donald Trump has done is, you know, by starting off his campaign saying, you know, most Mexicans are rapists and some of them, I guess, are okay people, was an immediate green light. And I'll just go back to what Andrew Gillum said in his debate against Ron DeSantis. I'm not saying that Mr. DeSantis is a racist, but the racists think he's a racist. And that's really the reality with Donald Trump. As much as he's going so far out of his way, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, rather, is going so far out of her way to try to absolve him of all responsibility here. The reality is when anti-Semites, racists, neo-Nazis, Klan members, and others see something in your policies that they like and they want to endorse, that's part of the problem. And I think Donald Trump wouldn't be in this position, and people wouldn't be telling him not to come, even though he's very conservative, if he had been forthright from the very beginning about his opposition to racism, bigotry, and the like. But he's essentially tried to coexist with those individuals to promote either his own personal politics or at least his own personal political ambitions. I think people see that, and they don't want that kind of grandstanding, which is what he would be doing, using these funerals to grandstand as someone who's for unity, when in fact he has probably done more than any other politician since, you know, I don't even know, Richard Nixon, to try to stir up these kind of tensions in the country.
Go ahead, Dan Kovalik.
Yeah, well, George Wallace comes to mind as well, as a politician who made a career out of stirring up racial hatred. And clearly, you know, Trump came to power largely on a platform of, again, explicit hatred, particularly towards immigrants. And we have to remember that this Tree of Life synagogue was targeted not only because of its Jewish identity, but because it has worked very openly in support of immigrants and just had a ceremony honoring immigrants. So that type of hostility has been very open in the Trump administration. Of course, as we're speaking, Trump is sending troops to the border to possibly attack families who are fleeing instability and violence in their own countries. So this is a very serious matter, and Trump does bear a lot of responsibility for this.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the core of his rhetoric, I mean, this is someone who's embraced people like Chris Kobach and Brian Kemp, who are trying to purge and keep millions of black people from voting. This is someone who wants to strip all poor people of their health care in a way that, you know, sort of plays on these racialized narratives about the rhetoric of who is getting public assistance. The turning of Chicago into this, you know, meme about crime in America, the carnage in the streets of Chicago. I mean, it's very terrible, the community violence in Chicago, but just for people to actually note this, the past 2 years where we've seen very high murder rates are not the highest in the history of Chicago. In fact, they're actually, sadly, even though it's still so high, significantly down from the highs of 93, 94, and 95 in Chicago. And so you see that he's obviously trying to play on this image of criminality amongst black people, amongst immigrants, amongst Muslims, in order to create a sense of fear. I mean, the whole thing that the caravan is an invasion of the United States, to create this sense of fear about the foreign dark hordes who are flowing into the country or are already here, who are going to destroy the lives of well-meaning white people in middle America whose jobs were stolen away by the evil, sneaky Chinese. And, you know, there's enough kernels of truth in that that people really identify with it. But the reality is there's no, you have to be willfully ignorant to look at this type of rhetoric and say, oh, this is not stoking racism in America, anti-Semitism in America. When you have Judicial Watch, one of the most mainstream conservative legal groups out there, works very closely with the Trump administration and every Republican in Congress, and their leader is going on Fox News talking about the Soros-occupied State Department. I mean, that's not even a dog whistle. That's a clear signal to these neo-Nazis with this whole Zog belief, the Zionist-occupied government, oh, that guy from Judicial Watch is with us. And when you see a Lou Dobbs, who is a big early supporter of Trump and also a racist hater of immigrants, lifting up that kind of rhetoric, this is not even really that veiled. I mean, many of these people do have anti-Semitic views, and Donald Trump is playing the role of conductor, if you will, and allowing solos to come from different parts of his racist orchestra and then saying, oh, well, it's not me playing the instrument, so why are you blaming me?
That's Eugene Puryear. Eugene is the show host of By Any Means Necessary here at Radio Sputnik. We're also joined by Dan Kovalik. Dan is a human rights and labor lawyer. We're talking to him from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I want to talk about how the elites from the Democratic Party and the elites from the Republican Party are, of course, attacking each other and drawing in parts of the population. And I have to say that it's kind of easy for Trump to be able to attack the Democratic Party leaning media, what they call the liberal media, because in fact, the so-called elite resistance is not the resistance. They're in fact have been profiting from Donald Trump. They've been promoting Donald Trump. The reason Donald Trump is the president is because of them. And I want to play two audio clips and then get both Dan and Eugene to react to them. This is from Les Moonves. He is the former CEO of CBS, and he's speaking at the Morgan Stanley Technology, Media, and Telecom Conference in San Francisco in February 2016. And it's about how CBS and Leslie Moonves, am I saying it right?
Yep,
I'm always
close
getting it
enough.
Wrong.
Yep, he's got it. Hundreds of millions of dollars. He'll be okay.
Okay, so this is what he said about CBS's coverage of Donald Trump. And of course, it's the same with CNN, Zucker, who said almost the same thing about Donald Trump. Let's listen to what the CEO of CBS said about Donald Trump.
Man, who would have expected the ride we're all having right now? This is pretty amazing. And, you know, who would have thought that this circus would come to town? But, you know, it may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. That's all I got to say. So... What can I say? It's, you know, the money's rolling in, and this is fun.
The money flowing in, and they were giving Donald Trump almost constant 24/7 free media coverage. As much as we love our show here at Radio Sputnik, I just don't think it was Sputnik or RT that was, you know, the reason people started to learn about Donald Trump. And if they had from us, we were attacking Donald Trump. We were criticizing Donald Trump. Let's listen to a second audio clip again. Leslie Moonves from CBS CEO. Let's listen. Here it is.
I've never seen anything like this. And, you know, this is going to be a very good year for us. Sorry. It's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Go ahead. Keep going. Don't write. Somebody, I said that at another investor conference. The next day, some blog put out, Moonves supporting Trump wholeheartedly. I said, no. I'm not taking any sides. I'm just saying, for us, economically, Donald's place in this election is a good thing.
Dan Kovalik, go ahead.
Yeah, well, this demonstrates, you know, how important the profit motive is to these companies over everything else, you know, as the clips indicated, they may have been firmly opposed to some of the things or a lot of the things that Trump stands for, but we're happy to forsake those principles in order to make a lot of money. We're happy to do it. And then they end up with Trump. And by the way, they continue to make a lot of money with him as president. And they will continue to make money when he runs again in 2020. So it's quite disturbing, again, how the profit motive governs everything in this country, including politics.
Yeah, you know, the Shorstein Center at Harvard University, which covers a number of things in political media, actually did a study about this that I think is very relevant, because many studies have come out looking at the year 2016 and talking about whatever, however much free media coverage Trump got, $1 billion, whatever it is, and this is that. And that's relevant, but it's actually not the most important point. And I appreciate the Shorstein Center for researching this, because they looked at what's known as the pre-primary period, right? So year before the election, handful of people start to trickle in. It's not clear who exactly is going to win. Maybe think 2007, fall of 2007, October 2007. Everybody thought Barack Obama, who's this guy, Hillary Clinton, definitely going to win. John Edwards probably going to come in second. That sort of early jostling. What they found, the Shorstein Center, is that the media gave Trump. Now, remember that in 2015, in the study that they looked at this, January 1 to December 31st, 2015, I believe Trump got it in July of 2015, but be that as it may, everyone will remember this if you think back. He was considered a joke candidate, to have no chance at all, that it was just a novelty. News media gave him $55 million in ad equivalent free coverage in the pre-primary period, more than any other candidate of either party, including every other Republican, including the people who were well-known politicians, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, people who thought were going to win. So it's not just that they were obsessively covering him once it was clear that Trump was a story. They saw from the very beginning, we will make a lot of money. They all know Donald Trump. He did The Apprentice. He's a rich, wealthy guy who moves in these circles. They knew from the very beginning, this guy will drive ratings. Now, they probably didn't think he was going to win, but they knew he will drive ratings. They saw him come down on the escalator, say all Mexicans are rapists, and they could see in the gold reflections of those gaudy escalators in Trump Tower their own financial futures, and they gave him this free coverage to pump him up and make him a serious candidate, because they knew if he got to the debates, they would be able to make more money than they ever were before. And it was Donald Trump who, quite frankly, pointed that out in the second debate debate when he said he was going to charge CNN $5 million for him to appear because he's like, I'm generating all the content for them. It was 100% obvious, and he played them because he knows the media well. He knows the media, especially cable news, is like a dying business, and the number one thing they need is ratings. He knew he could deliver it. Every single major media publication in this country is now doubling down on political coverage. Politico has 7 White House reporters, and they're still hiring more because they're trying to find a way to capitalize on what Trump showed you could do, which is the monetization of political outrage.
Dan Kovalik, you, me, Eugene, all of us, we're not only people on radio, we're also people who care. We're people who are involved in social movements. We're organizers. You know, the people who are organizing, who are really organizing, we never get any coverage in the corporate-owned media. And then people attack us if we come on Sputnik and say, well, why are you on Sputnik? Well, guess what? MSNBC is not going to let us on. CNN's not going to let us on. MSNBC and Rachel Maddow, they're not going to let us on. But they'd be glad to rant and rave either early on about Donald Trump, whatever he did, or now against Donald Trump now that he's president. And for them, it's not only a form of recreation, it's still a form of money making, which is completely different from what's motivating grassroots opposition to Donald Trump. Like, we are not making money. We are not getting coverage. We do have majority sentiment with us when we go out and organize, but that's not reflected at all in the corporate-owned media. I mean, Americans are getting a very skewed image over the issue of polarization because whether it's Fox News or MSNBC, they're not doing it out of principle. Their righteousness is false. They're really doing it strictly for profits, for ratings.
Yes, and as you say, I mean, when you look at the polls, the American people, by large majorities, tend to be very progressive on the issues. But you would have no idea about that, as you say, from the mainstream press, because they like to, as you say, profit from giving voice to very extreme voices, particularly extreme voices from the right. And so one has the impression that, in fact, the right, the extreme right, talks for a lot more people than they do. I think the most a recent poll I saw was that only, you know, 6% of the population would be considered of the extreme right. But again, you get the impression from the media that it's a much larger number because of the inordinate amount of coverage those people get. And they get that coverage because it increases ratings and therefore increases dollars. It's a quite insidious game that they're playing.
Eugene, I want to go back to Mike Pence's speech. Again, we're talking about the falsity of the right-wing media, the falsity of the so-called liberal media. And again, these words actually don't mean anything anymore. They're just labels that are bandied about. They actually have zero meaning. So I wouldn't mind at some point not using them. But let's go back. I want to play another audio clip and then get you to comment because this, again, is this amazing spectacle with Mike Pence about supposedly mourning over the people who died at the synagogue. The next clip is from an event last night where Vice President Pence invited, as you said, a messianic Jewish rabbi to pray for the congregation that was targeted in the mass shooting. He invoked Jesus, the Messiah, this is the rabbi, and briefly praying for the families of those who were killed before he moved on to hear what you're about to hear. And then he went on to stump for Republicans running for the midterm elections. I mean, you can't get more gross. Is it grosser or more gross? I don't know.
It's both of them.
It's more gross, man. It's gross. Let's listen to Mike Pence, gross vice president.
I pray for the president and his family and for Vice President Pence and his family and for the members of the cabinet and their families that you would bless them, protect them, surround them with grace and peace, and bless them with your salvation. I pray that you would enable Vice President Pence to continue to fulfill his many and important responsibilities with excellence. I pray for Attorney General Bill Schuette, who's running for governor, for Congressman Mike Bishop, who is running again for Congress, for Lena Epstein, who is running for Congress, for John James, who is running for the Senate.
Okay, gross. I mean, this is for the victims who just got killed at the synagogue. He's praying for Vice President Pence and all the other Republican candidates.
Totally politicized.
Unbelievable. I mean, and also just the fact that he started out by talking about how politicians and people in power are ordained by Jesus. But, I mean, you couldn't be any more disrespectful to invite on stage someone whose entire subset of religious beliefs is based on nullifying the Jewish religion on so many different ways. I mean, some people call them Jews for Jesus. I mean, they aren't really Jews. I mean, you can hear when he's praying to God for their salvation that salvation through Jesus is not a Jewish thing. I mean, it literally, the core beliefs of Judaism are actually completely eroded by this messianic Jewish thing, which is really just a secret Christian plot to convert Jews. And I hate to say it like that, but it's true. I mean, that's just the reality of it. And what message could you send to Jewish people in America to say, we're going to bring up this so-called rabbi, all of whose beliefs are basically nullifying yours? And then he does it, like, maybe the guy could have saved it if it all would have been about the people who were killed and we're all, no matter who we are, all coming into line because it's such a terrible thing. But to barely even mention the people who were killed, and then, you know, when you watch the video, he's, like, reading off this piece of paper. So he was just handed a piece of paper of random candidates no one has ever heard of to pray for them. I mean, on every single level, it's just demeaning, quite frankly, to anyone, quite frankly, not just Jews, anyone who thinks this was a terrible, horrible event that took place there at the Tree of Life Synagogue.
Dan Kovalik, you shared with us before this show started a new article by Max Blumenthal at Gray Zone Project. Members of Netanyahu's Likud blame victims of Pittsburgh's pogrom and echo the killer's rhetoric. Robert Bowers, as Max Blumenthal writes, the right-wing terrorist who killed all these people, targeted the congregation on the basis of its partnership with the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, a Jewish nonprofit that helps refugees from conflict-torn regions obtain asylum in the United States. And Bowers said in his explanation for why he killed all these people, HIAS, that's the Jewish aid organization, likes to bring invaders that kill our people. Again, that's coming from Trump, too, because who are the invaders? He's talking about the caravan.
Mm-hmm.
That's who he's talking about.
I think it's 100% true. I mean, I think that, I mean, the dark tones that Trump is so willing to paint and then try to walk away from responsibility. I mean, I think this is pretty consistent with him, that he's sort of refused to take responsibility for any role that he has particularly played and then goes right back down to it. I mean, obviously, I'm not the biggest fan of the mainstream media, but to even follow this up by saying the media is the enemy of the people in the context of all this violence, the murder at the grocery store in Kentucky,
so
the
dangerous
bombing issue. I mean, it's just unnecessarily inflammatory and designed to rile up people like this.
Dan Kovalik, we have a little less than 2 minutes. Let's go back to Max's article. What's up with the Likud government representatives who are blaming the victims? Talk about what Max Blumenthal's point is here.
Yes, well, I mean, what he points out is that, you know, there's a number of leaders, particularly amongst the right wing in Israel, that have been very critical of synagogues like the Tree of Life for their support of immigrants, and who actually do not even consider the members of the Tree of Life true Jews because they're conservatives. And so the point that he's making is that Israel also takes this bizarre line on this massacre, which is less than fully supportive of the people who were killed.
Yeah, and Naftali Bennett is who Israel sent there to represent them. A guy who, I think he said something along the line of, I kill Arabs every day, or I've killed a lot. One of the most xenophobic, racist, Arab-hating, pro-destruction of Palestinian life and livelihood people in the entire Israeli government, and that's the person that they have seen. And I've seen many people cynically taking advantage of this to say that all Jews in America should now move to Israel because it's the only safe place for them. So it's pretty disgusting how these Israeli government-related officials are using this essentially for their own opportunistic purposes.
Dan Kovalik, less than 1 minute. You know, the New York Times today said the Pittsburgh massacre showed a cleavage, a division within the American Jewish community regarding Israel. Clearly that is the case, and clearly that's the case right where you are in Pittsburgh. 45 seconds. Take us out in terms of a brief comment on that.
Well, I certainly think there is a division, although I think, again, the polls are showing that certainly amongst young people, Israel's losing support amongst young Jews. I think a lot of people are becoming very disgusted with how the Palestinians are being treated, and I think you do see some of that in the rhetoric that's coming out after this massacre, and including, again, from some an Israeli ambassador was, in fact, tried to make the point that you can't just blame the right for the massacre, but you also have to blame the left on college campuses. And he was clearly referring to the BDS movement. So clearly, Israel's going to use this as another hammer against pro-Palestinian people, including pro-Palestinian Jews.
Yeah, just want to note that even when I looked at this yesterday, there was like 35,000 people, I think mostly Jewish, who had signed the petition against President Trump coming. So you can see that there's quite a bit of opposition there.
That's all the time we have. We were joined in studio by Eugene Puryear. Eugene is the host of the Sputnik News Show, By Any Means Necessary. You can hear it every day, 2 to 4 p.m., Monday through Friday at 105.5 FM, 1390 AM, and at sputniknews.com. And we were joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. Dan is the author of several books, including The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Tuesday, and that means we continue our weekly series. We hold this segment every Tuesday with Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. The segment is called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from Florida this time by Mr. Sankey. Usually he talks to us from the Northern California area. Daniel Sankey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You're in a warmer environment than you normally are.
That is certainly true. The weather here is quite nice.
We don't want to talk about that at the moment because we'll feel envious of you. But but let's talk about, of course, the economy's in the news. I mean, you just have to glance at the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times business page to see that there's a growing sense of fear and of pessimism, sort of a sense of alarm that something bad is about to happen. And of course, there's been all the volatility in the stock market, which we talked about last week. It's having very, very steep decreases, and then it'll bounce back, but not quite as much. Anyway, we're living, obviously, sort of probably at the tail end of an economic expansion, the so-called boom part of the boom-bust cycle in capitalism. That means that eventually their stock prices will deflate. That means eventually there will be a recession. That means eventually even those people who have finally made it back to the job market after the terrible impact of the, quote, Great Recession, close quote, they're going to lose their jobs. We know that that's part of this economic system. But, you know, for a lot of people in this country, Daniel Sankey, there was no boom. There was just a bust. And the bust has endured. And I'm thinking specifically of those who don't have homes. And that's a lot of people in America. I want to talk about this issue of a tax on tech companies for the homeless. I want you to walk us through that and then talk about the bigger picture of why the companies, the corporations, the mega monopolies almost that make so much money, have so many resources, are unwilling to really part with it in the form of a tax that would be designed to relieve the problems of homeless people, meaning give them shelter. Go ahead.
Yeah. So what's been in the news lately is a discussion that's being had in the UK and more broadly in Europe about having a special tax for information tech companies like Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, where they're discussing special taxes on them, which these companies are able to avoid by largely claiming certain tax loopholes, claiming that they're out of country and not, you know, there in those particular countries, and taking advantage of laws that really were created prior to this sort of kind of stateless, nebulous tech industry that sort of exists in the cloud, if you will. And because of that, they've been able to take advantage of a lot of tax laws that were not equipped to deal with them. And now the European Union and the UK are trying to crack down and trying to actually tax these companies. I think in the news, we saw recently that there was very large multi-billion dollar fines levied against Google for how they were essentially monopolizing advertising and pushing other operating firms or operating systems out of markets, and that you determined that that was a problem. And of course, the tech companies are fighting it tooth and nail. They don't want this sort of tax to be levied against them. I think one of the most important things is to think about, where do these companies get their money? How do they make their money? And how they make their money is using consumer data, user data. So they track everything their users do, every minute little detail of how they browse within their services, what they click on, what they hover over but don't click on, what they start to type in but then stop and erase and type something else in. They collect all of that and they monetize it, mainly through advertising. There's a number of other ways as well, but advertising is a big one. So they're saying, you know, they can go to Europe, they can go to UK, they can collect all this customer data from Europeans and UK citizens, and then sell it. But they don't want to be taxed by those countries. They don't want these taxes to be put in place. They'll happily profit off of them and their people, but they don't want to actually have to give it back. And that is in part why these companies have such massive super profits, is because of their ability to dodge a lot of these tax laws. And so we're seeing right now a big fight in those two areas between the tech giants and the governments of those various nations.
It's interesting how this capitalist system actually works, modern day, late stage capitalism. The capitalists have no responsibility to anyone other than basically to themselves, to the investors, and especially to the biggest investors. And that responsibility is to maximize profits. And part of the dynamic here is that even if you had a good-hearted CEO of one of these companies that said, guess what? We're going to show the way for other capitalists. We'll show that we're not all evil money bags. We're going to do something to help the homeless. We're going to volunteer to pay a certain percentage of our profits to create a fund so that there are no homeless people, because obviously it's not necessary. It's an evil of the system where even working people, employed people, can't finance their own homes. They don't want to give like even the smallest scintilla from that profits. And I guess the logic is, if one of them does it, then the others will benefit by showing their investors, we can give you a greater return on your profit because we're not paying the same sort of social tax that the EU is now demanding, for instance. So what the EU is saying in turn is, look, let's make it across the board. It won't be, we're not going to sort of decide on volunteerism where one good capitalist does something that negates or harms their company so that other evil capitalists can take advantage of it. Let's make it an across the board tax. But the response therein too is that all of these capitalist corporations say, no, we're going to do everything possible to resist that. Now, Daniel, you're in California, where people can't afford to live anymore because rents are too damn high and because mortgages are out of control. So you and others have been working on Prop 10 to try to create an environment that would facilitate the return, at least in some small measure, to affordable housing. And these same corporate entities, in concert with the banks and the real estate developers, are trying to stop that. So in each and every way, they feel no obligation whatsoever to society. Their only obligation is to maximize profits.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's what you see, especially in these real estate markets, is, you know, these companies who have profited so greatly off of the communities that they're in, who have allowed in California this, you know, amazing tech bubble to be created, are totally unwilling to give back in any real substantial way to the communities that they're around. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm involved in fighting for Prop 10 to be passed, so that we can finally have the ability, just the ability, not the guarantee, but the ability to fight for local rent control in different cities and counties. And it's being fought by Wall Street. It's being fought by the tech giants, because for them, they don't need houses to live in. They're fantastically wealthy. They can have multiple homes that they want, and many do. They want houses to invest in, and they want houses to speculate on, because real estate bubbles and real estate prices can be very profitable if you know how to speculate correctly. And so what we're seeing in, you know, the so-called American dream, i.e. home ownership, is really dwindling and is really being replaced by large private equity firms, large corporations that own housing. I think one of the most striking examples is the tech giants like Google and Facebook are actually creating company housing. So they're creating housing just for employees to live in, of which, of course, the employees pay a certain percentage out of their paycheck for rent. This kind of is akin to me to company towns like they had back in the coal mining days, where the housing was owned by the company, the general store was owned by the company, and the employees were paid in script, which they could then exchange for food and goods rather than actual money. And in a lot of ways, that's kind of what we're seeing here, where these tech giants are just buying up all this real estate and just renting it out to their employees, and they control larger and larger and larger share of the markets. It's this kind of relentless monopolization that you see. And what you're seeing in the EU and the UK, at least compared to how the United States is that their government is actually willing to consider that maybe this is a real problem, and maybe there needs to be some kind of taxation, progressive in this case, to ensure that these tech giants, who have far more money than they'll ever need, give some of it back to people so they can have such luxuries like, oh, I don't know, homes or basic income. And of course, these companies are going to fight it nonstop. I think also one thing we want to touch on too that you mentioned, Brian, is kind of the good-hearted capitalist that was going to give some of his money away. I think what we need to point out is the kind of systemic nature of capitalism, that, you know, it's not really an individual choice. It's a community. It's a systemic decision. So even if there was that good-hearted capitalist that said, oh, I just want to help people, that person would quickly go out of business because, of course, the other corporations would refuse to. They would produce more profits because they weren't giving away a dime. And whatever investors that good-hearted capitalist had would leave, their funds would leave towards these other companies that are willing to give back nothing or give as little as they can to the surrounding communities. That's why even if there was this good-hearted capitalist, that person wouldn't be successful. That person would be pushed out and replaced by someone who's willing to give even less. So it's a systemic nature of things. It's not just a moral individual choice. It's how wealth is organized in our society.
John Kiriakou, we're talking with Daniel Sankey as we do every Tuesday, a weekly look at corporate capitalism and the avarice, the greed. It's not simply this corporation or this CEO. It's across the board. And it's not just here where the tech companies are resisting doing anything to share the burden in Europe, in this case, where the EU is trying to impose a taxation on them to solve some of the social problems.
Right.
But again, they're not alone here.
Oh, no, we face the same issue here in the United States in spades. In 2015, Bernie Sanders proposed something that at first glance, at least to me, seems like the perfect solution to the problem of funding social programs. What he proposed was a very, very small excise tax, which would have been 1/100 of 1% of the amount of trades on stocks, bonds, derivatives, and other securities. 1/100 of 1%. Now, that would raise $185 billion over 10 years. And what Bernie was proposing was using that money to expand pre-kindergarten programs for 3- and 4-year-olds, and also to restore funding of college assistance for low-income students. Now, this is the kind of tax where literally no one would miss the money. The percentage is so small, and it's not levied against consumers. It's levied on these financial transactions. Nobody would miss the money, and these important social deficits would be taken care of. But of course, you know, Congress being what it is, this bill never went anywhere.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about that, actually, because that particular legislation that was proposed would impact what are called high-frequency traders. So for your average consumer who might buy or sell stocks, they're going to do it once in a while. They're going to do little amounts, you know, for those that can actually afford to speculate that way. And many working people can't. They have to keep their money somewhere safe where they can't kind of have a more or less guarantee that it won't lose value. But high frequency traders, which is this multi-billion dollar industry, really trade on the tiny, minute price fluctuations between assets. And so if you look at the little ticker tape, if you ever go and look at the Dow or something, you can see it move up and down, and you can see the prices change from second to second. And oftentimes, the price changes are minute. They're very small amounts. But the truth is that these high-frequency traders exploit those tiny amounts, and they make billions of dollars off of penny differences. Well, if you make a penny off a stock, for your average person, that's nothing, right? You haven't made any money. But if you're doing it with hundreds of millions of dollars and you make a penny off a stock, that's a lot of money. So what Bernie was proposing is these high-frequency traders should have to pay more of their fair share. And really, high-frequency traders provide no real service to society. They provide no real goods or services that people need. It's a form of very sophisticated gambling where you exploit these tiny little price fluctuations with millions and millions of dollars. And so he was saying, hey, you are kind of, you know, vampires on society. You're not benefiting anyone. Let's take some of your money and what the heck, let's give it to, I don't know, kindergarten teachers or, you know, after school programs or things like that. And of course, they're going to fight back with all the billions of dollars they're going to be making so that they can continue to exploit tiny price differences that really just amounts to very high tech financialized gambling.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel is talking to us this week, as he does every Tuesday, about the big economic issues of the week. This time he's talking to us from Florida. John Kiriakou, I want to spend a little bit more time on this before we go into other stories, because here you have government, in this case the EU, European-wide government, trying to do something to say to the corporations, look, we have big, vast social problems. This is actually the big part of what's leading to the rise of the ultra-right in Europe. We have big, unattended to, unresolved social and economic problems that are affecting some parts of the population greatly. They're not being impacted because of a personal failure. This is a part of the social system. When you have tens of millions of people or millions of people impacted the same way, then it's not an individual defect. It's a societal defect. It's a social order defect. So the EU government, kind of along the lines, but in a less grandiose way than, say, what FDR did in the 1930s, is trying to say to the capitalists, look, in order to have stability, in order to not have radical polarization and extreme movements or even revolutions, let's try to mitigate some of the worst manifestations of the social or economic system as it impacts, say, the unemployed or people who are low income and can't afford housing. Now, they're all resisting. This is, as you pointed out, and as Daniel's talking about, even Bernie Sanders' proposal resisted across the board, even though it would have been such a small little bit of an impact on their corporate profits. Let's go back to where this issue of social programs really became a thing, because when capitalism first formed in the 19th century or 18th century, there were no social programs. You either worked or you starved. As a matter of fact, in the 1930s, during the middle of the Depression, when there was no unemployment insurance and there was no Social Security apparatus, in other words, if you're unemployed, you starved, the slogan of the left at that time, of the Communist Party, which was a big party, and the Americans don't know it, but the communist and socialist movement was strong here. Mm-hmm. The slogan in 1933 was, fight, don't starve. Because 5,000 people were literally starving
to death.
Yeah.
Yes.
And 20,
in the United States.
In the United States. And 25% of the population was unemployed. 25% official. Mm-hmm. That's the official number. Now, Roosevelt introduced the WPA. He gave workers who were unemployed jobs. The Social Security system, whereby if you turned 62 or 65, instead of dying because you could no longer have an income, you were guaranteed some minimal retirement, that Social Security, things that we depend on now and assume are just fundamental. They also, Roosevelt and the New Deal also introduced unemployment insurance. Now, to pay for unemployment insurance or to pay for Social Security, it meant that the corporate capitalists had to pay a tax. Workers paid a tax too.
Right.
The employee paid a tax, but they were matched by the bosses, by the employers. Now, people don't, because Roosevelt has this sort of significant aura, halo around his head now, people might not recognize that, in fact, when Roosevelt tried to introduce these programs, he was considered by the bankers and the corporate tycoons of that day to be a complete communist class traitor.
In fact, he was accused very specifically of being a communist and a class traitor.
Yeah, because he was from the upper class. He was from the capitalist class himself, from the banking elites, the Roosevelt family. But, you know, he made a comment which was very telling when he was introducing these programs. The programs were demanded by the left, demanded by the unions. It was a time of radicalization. People were seizing factories. In 1934, there were general strikes in Toledo, Ohio, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and San Francisco. General strikes shut down the entire city. By 1935 and 36, the sit-down strike, like what happened at Flint, Michigan, was sweeping the country. More than 1,000 factories were seized by angry workers. Now, under those conditions, Roosevelt, on behalf of the system, started making concessions vis-a-vis unemployment insurance, Social Security, etc. He said then, don't these fools, meaning the bankers and the corporate capitalists, don't these fools realize I'm saving capitalism? You know, he was helping the poor, but he was helping the poor to save capitalism.
Yeah, because he understood that in 1933, hungry people take to the streets, and the United States was truly at risk of a revolution. Yeah. And those bankers and those capitalists may have found themselves in the gallows had he not done something to feed the poor.
Yeah, it was designed to prevent revolution. I mean, it wasn't the goodness of his heart. He could see what was happening. And Daniel Sankey, let's go back to you. When you think about, you know, we think about, oh, Sweden has such a vast social insurance program, or France, or these other European countries. Those were countries that were close to the Soviet Union. I mean, geographically in proximity to the Soviet Union, which after the revolution that Roosevelt was trying to prevent in America actually happened in 1917 in Russia, the Soviet government introduced this vast social insurance program. People were guaranteed a right to a job, free education, free health care, all of those things. And as a consequence, when the European corporate banking elites looked out over what was going on socially and in terms of the political struggle, they thought, guess what? Maybe we should adopt some of these social insurance programs that Roosevelt was advocating, but even more widespread, to stop the, quote, revolution from coming to their countries. There was kind of a class conscious effort to prevent something from getting even worse for the banking and corporate elites. Anyway, that's the big framework here. And these programs are under attack and have been underfunded, I think, because the elites no longer fear, I think they will again, but they no longer fear at the moment, this danger of social revolution.
That's a really important point, because when we talk about these progressive changes, we have to understand them in the context of a class struggle. Back then, like you said, there was major threats to the stability and power of the elites, the banking class, the very wealthy. In the United States, like you said, they had seized some factories. And then you could go even further into Europe, where not only their proximity to the Soviet Union, but the fact that socialist movements there had been around for longer, were stronger, were more entrenched, their ideas were more popular at the time. And if they push too hard, if the elites push too hard, there's a high likelihood of organized in a really significant way to seize power. We have to understand these elites don't give in out of the goodness of their hearts, like the kind capitalists we were talking about. They don't pass out these benefits because they feel bad for people or they feel some kind of moral obligation to society. They do it under threat, under coercion. And right now, I think that the ruling class in the United States feels very secure of their position. It's why they are so disconnected from the vast majority of U.S. people, because they don't really feel the need to conform to it anyway. They have their free ability to create profit. They have, you know, a white supremacist sympathizer in the highest office of power. Fascism is on the rise, which, of course, has always been the enemy of working people and progressive change. And they feel like they don't have the need to really dole out any crumbs, you know. And even if we ask for those crumbs so we don't starve, you know, what are we going to do about it, they think. And I think because we're at a stage right now where that class struggle is really weak here in the United States, where workers don't feel empowered, don't feel united, don't feel the push to fight back in a really united way with really clear demands, the elites will continue to exploit the situation. What we need, if we want those progressive changes, though, is that unity, is those clear demands, and is working people to see that common class character, that we're all working people together, regardless of our unique backgrounds, regardless of our unique situations, that we find that common point of unity, that we are not bankers, we are not global elites, we are not the exploiters. We are common working people, and on that basis, come together in unity and demand things that we as workers know we need, housing, healthcare, jobs, etc. And if and when we start producing a movement like that again, which has been produced in the past and can definitely be produced again, only then will we start seeing these real progressive changes. Only then will we see bankers and elites trying to backpedal, trying to, oh, okay, you can have some more. We don't want to threaten this. Then you can see, might see something like more of a FDR renaissance. But that's what it's dependent on. It's not dependent on other factors. It's dependent on that important class struggle.
Daniel Sankey is our guest, as he is every Tuesday here on Loud and Clear. You can hear Loud and Clear every day if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM at 1390 AM. You can follow us on Facebook at Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. You can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also subscribe as a podcast on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and Spotify and Spreaker. Daniel, we have about 4 minutes left. Talking about the Flint sit-down strike, that was again against General Motors. General Motors was one of the three big auto companies, but let's talk about a second big auto company because right now it is in trouble. And of course, I'm talking about the Ford Corporation, but I'm talking also about the Ford workers. What's going on?
All right. So Ford is reporting having lost about $1 billion. And this is due to the trade tariffs that Trump has issued around the world, especially in China. And so Ford has seen a $1 billion loss in profitability due to the fact that a lot of the inputs that come from other countries that are used to create Ford cars are becoming much more expensive than they were before. And so naturally, then the costs have to be passed on, and ultimately profitability is lost. What is relevant about this, especially for our conversation, is that $1 billion loss is going to result in a round of mass layoffs that Ford is going to get engage in as it has to scale back production. The reason why, you know, I wanted to mention this is because Donald Trump posed those tariffs as a way of fighting back against China and getting jobs back for workers. And I think it's really important. We look at this American standard, Ford, right, which is kind of almost synonymous with the U.S. flag in a way, this company that's been with the United States for a long time and was created here, is being forced to lay off workers because of the very policies that Trump is saying will benefit workers. I think it's important that we talk about this because a lot of Trump's rhetoric that appeals to a lot of people is he wants to talk about jobs, and workers. He wants to create a strong economy so workers can make money and provide for themselves and their families. But Trump knows what these policies will do, and he is no friend of working people. He knows the harm that these policies will cause. And we're seeing it even now. And so working people really need to think carefully when they're considering these policies that are being put forth, that you can talk about jobs all day long and say you love workers, but look at what they're really putting forth. Trump is a multimillionaire, a very successful real estate mogul. He's never had to work a day in his life. All of his work has been voluntary. He could have retired at any time and lived a life of luxury. He is not an ally of people in factories.
Trump became a millionaire at age 8 because he was getting $200,000 a year from daddy.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
He earned every penny of it, though. He was that wonderful as a child. 60 seconds left. Last story. Risky deals return to leveraged buyout market. Extra debt rises. Use of equity cash drops. What's that story?
So essentially that story is that we're seeing another risky loan market blooming up, much like we had in the early days of 2008, where companies are taking on huge debt, millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, to buy out other companies in the hopes that the companies they'll buy out, they'll be able to sell for more money and pay back that debt. It's a risky way of buying and merging companies and creating monopolies, and it's also a risky way of speculating on investments.
It's just flipping companies. In other words, doing nothing to add workers.
Exactly. Flipping companies does nothing to add workers, reduces workers, in fact. A lot of times people have to be laid off to make those companies profitable. And these loans that back this whole thing creates more instability in the markets, more future uncertainty that can ultimately result in more economic instability, which, as we know, just hurts workers in the long run.
That's Daniel Sankey. Daniel's a financial policy analyst in Northern California. Today, we were talking to him from Florida. You can hear this segment every Tuesday on Loud and Clear. It's called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.